From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise can help you manage your money in different currencies. With Wise, you can send money to your cousin in Australia in seconds. Travel internationally without having to brave an airport currency exchange desk or take the guesswork out of converting currencies. Wise lets you send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate, all without any hidden fees. Join 60 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. If you're a small business owner, you know that it isn't just your business, it's your life. And whatever your business might be, you want someone who understands. That's why you might want to check out State Farm Small Business Insurance. Why? Because State Farm agents are small business owners too, living and working in your community. That means they know what it takes to help you personalize your policies for your small business needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
When I was in grad school, a friend of mine suggested I read a book by an old cultural anthropologist I had never heard of before. The book was called The Denial of Death, and the author was Ernest Becker. It was published in 1973, and it was a massive hit at the time. Becker even won the Pulitzer Prize the following year, just a couple months after he died of cancer. The big thesis was that the majority of human behavior is driven by an unconscious desire to ignore our own mortality, that we do what we do, attach ourselves to the things we attach ourselves to, in order to avoid the reality of our eventual extinction. Becker would often talk about this in elusive ways that pointed to the almost religious dimensions of the problem.
I think that underneath everything that is at stake in human life is the problem of the terror of this planet. It is a mystic temple and hall of doom. If you don't see it that way, you have built defenses against seeing it as it is.
That's a clip from a new documentary about Becker's life and thought. I wasn't even aware of the film until a couple of weeks ago, but I was thrilled to watch it and sort of rediscover Becker's ideas, which always struck me as timeless in the way great works of philosophy are. The movie, like Becker's book, gets into your head and stays there. And that, as much as anything, speaks to the enduring power of the message. I'm Sean Illing, and this is The Gray Area. Today's guest is Jeff Sewell. He's one of the filmmakers behind the Becker documentary. The film is called All Illusions Must Be Broken, and it orbits around a remarkably candid and intimate interview Becker did just before his death. The movie captures Becker's most essential ideas and connects them to our present moment. It's a sobering experience, but it's also profound and moving and all too human. When I watched it, I knew immediately that I wanted to talk to Jeff about it. Jeff Sewell, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
This documentary is incredible, and it lingers for a long time. I watched it last week, and it is still ping-ponging in my head. How do you describe it?
Well, I think what I would say is that the film is exploring this broad theme of the eclipse of nature by culture. It began in the ideas of Richard Louv. I don't know if you're familiar with his book, The Last Child in the Woods, but It was an exploration of what he called nature deficit disorder and how children are growing up increasingly indoors and online and on screens. So that's where we started. But at some point, maybe halfway through production, I just told Laura, I think we're missing something. We're really documenting the what of what's going on, but we're not documenting the why. And that's really where Ernest Becker's ideas came into the film. his ideas continue to be relevant. They're more relevant than they were when he wrote the book, which was 1973. So I think it was this realization of we need to bring this writer's ideas to the present and show how we really anticipated not the technological development so much as the cultural trend.
Why do you feel like his ideas are particularly relevant now and people need to know about them?
I think maybe a way to say that is that human denial has never been greater. A pattern of denial of reality itself has just grown. And so as you think about children not wanting to grow up and be outside and wanting to spend time in virtual environments, there's a cost to that. There's a cost to that in terms of their development as creatures. And this is really where Becker kind of logically enters the frame, because Becker's idea was human beings are really split in two, and that a person is a symbolic self and understands themselves as an identity and has a name. But that's all sitting on top of a different thing, which is the animal body, which itself faces, you know, aging, decay, and eventual death. And that's an impossible predicament, as Becker really explores. And so I think if you start to see our move in the United States in particular away from the agrarianism that's characterized our species for the entirety of human culture, we're not actually experiencing those regular immersions in the physical world. And Becker was sort of, what are the consequences of children not getting time outdoors? Well, they're losing access to the experiences that help them understand themselves more existentially. We didn't know that his voice would come to denominate the whole film when we started, but it eventually did. And it really just allowed us to speak to this larger question of what's the trade-off of people spending more and more time within environments that are themselves symbolic and fictional, and less time in the physical world.
It is a very deep and very challenging film. What are you hoping it communicates to audiences? What do you want people to feel when they see it?
Well, you know, gosh, this is going to sound absurd.
Go for it.
My initial encounter with Ernest Becker came after I had undergone an existential crisis that was triggered by a dawning awareness of something that we all actually face. I'm not sure exactly why this sudden onset of an acute awareness of the human condition or the existential dilemma hit me so hard, but it did, and I had no words to process it. So when I came to Becker later, my experience of reading the book was one of largely of elation and that feeling of, I am so grateful that there's someone who understands this problem. Becker places a considerable emphasis on the role of terror. And in our society in the United States, we are typically very optimistic. We're often shallow. We're often salespeople, and we're endlessly self-promotional. And I think what's been shocking to me is to watch how the advent of the internet has hyper-accelerated this pattern.
The anchor of the film is an interview Becker did with the philosopher Sam Keen.
Recording an interview with Ernest Becker.
I don't know exactly what you want to talk about, what you want to hear from me, what kind of thing you want me to elaborate, what kind of thing you want my opinions on.
Is it accidental that you became fascinated with the topic of death?
How'd you come across that?
So this did not begin with that particular audio available. I'd found a transcript of it somewhere, and I was convinced that it was really getting at what we were missing. But when we got that audio, we began incorporating it into the rough cut of the film. And at some point, I realized that Sam Keen was still alive and thought, could we go talk to him? And so we asked if he would be willing to speak to us, and he agreed to. So we packed up the van and drove to Sonoma in the middle of COVID and did the interview with him that serves as really the foundation of the film's narrative structure. And he said he did not know where the audio was. So when we asked him, we've read a transcript of this, do you know where this is? He says, I don't. Eventually it was recovered by someone named Lila Rothschild, who was with the Ernest Becker Foundation, she had this belief that it might be stored in a cabin in Washington state. And so she went and found it. And it's very different when you suddenly hear this voice. And not everyone has a voice that's able to be made the foundation of a film where there's no video of them.
Well, let's get into his ideas. And I guess the denial of death is a good place to start. Is it fair to say that the denial of death is the book that made Becker famous?
Yeah, Becker actually lived largely in academic obscurity. His writings were really circulated among specialists, sociology and within anthropology, but he struggled to break through. And The Denial of Death was the book that did it. But it came out as Becker was already himself dying. He didn't write the manuscript aware of his own sickness. But when it was released, he was in the hospital.
What would you say was the main thesis of that book for people who are totally unfamiliar with it?
The basic thesis is that we're repressing our awareness of our own mortality. That's the secret thing we're trying to hide from ourselves. And the way that we do it is we actually, quote, tranquilize ourselves with the trivial. We spend our time in activities and in diversions to avoid thinking about this stuff. So Becker's argument really was that one's entire lifestyle is a dishonesty, really, that is an attempt to evade the existential dilemma, that one is a characterological lie, that your identity is itself a fiction you built to protect you from the reality that you face as a self-aware but mortal animal. The idea of basically accusing the mass of people of lying to themselves, it's pretty bold. You know, it's almost comical how bold and, in a sense, rude it is. But I think at the same time, there's a very provocative argument to be made that it's happening all around us.
He says at one point that there's a kind of contradiction we're all living with when it comes to our creatureliness, to use a favorite word of his. And I think he's really, really right about this. We have this need to believe that we're unique individuals with some special importance, but that desire, that need is undermined by the reality of our extinction. And so we just live.
Yes.
We have to live in this uneasy tension between these two poles. And that's kind of what he's trying to direct our attention to.
Absolutely. When you look at a graveyard and you look at what the typical structure of a graveyard is, there's some stone or object that's got some bit of writing that tells you the person's name and often how long they lived. And this is supposed to be a testament or a monument. It's like we can't all afford to build the pyramids of Egypt as our tomb. We can't afford to leave these massive edifices that attest to our specialness. But, you know, we'll give everybody a little headstone. But what Becker, in a certain way, is saying, all of culture itself is doing this. Everything you're doing is an attempt to leave a mark behind. It's not just something you drop at the end. Your book, your movie, your album, your children, everything is a drive to attest to one's specialness. And yet it's done in most cases automatically and uncritically and without awareness. And so, you know, Becker, one way of describing his goal, he said, you know, I made it a study to understand why people do what they do. It's one thing to think about that from the standpoint of an anthropologist, but it's another thing to ask, why exactly am I doing what I'm doing right now? What am I doing?
There's that great Nietzsche line that the first sign that an animal is human is that it's no longer dedicated to its momentary comfort, but rather to its enduring comfort. And that line always stuck with me because it speaks to all the torments and anxieties that open up once a creature becomes aware of time and history and death and all of these sorts of things. It's the human predicament, really.
It's also equipping. I think that people automatically assume that this is all, you know, nihilistic and dark, and it's not. Because I think with Becker, there is this also this recognition of the profound mystery of our existence. the fact that we are here at all and capable of this self-reflection is often, I think, chalked up to some accident. And yet, it's a profound mystery why there's something rather than nothing.
I heard someone refer to Becker's philosophy as melancholic existentialism.
Yeah.
Does that seem accurate to you?
It does. I mean, I think it's fair to say that.
I don't know.
I think it's some of it's stoic.
Yeah, there's some of that. I guess it feels like a bit of a mistake for me to conclude that Becker is embracing sadness. That's kind of what it sounds like.
Maybe what's fair to say is it might look sad because it seems like it's ruminating on these heavy themes, but I don't feel encumbered having absorbed this material at all. I feel elated. I'm profoundly grateful. I mean, I don't know if you're aware of this, but it's something I wasn't aware of until we really did the research. But he was a 2-year Berkeley lecturer, and he was brought in by a friend. And this is Berkeley, peak Berkeley. So this is Berkeley 1966, 67, free speech movement. It is the zenith of what we think of when we think of Berkeley. And within that short period of time, he went from being a nobody to being the most popular class on campus. And he had 900 plus people, many of whom were not even in, of course, enrolled, coming just to hear him speak. This story became such a big deal that the faculty would not offer him a position and resented him and actually groused quite a bit about it. The students then organized and said, we're going to raise the money out of student donations. And they raised like $13,000 or $14,000 to keep him. And at that point, the administration refused to do it. And so this made Time magazine. I mean, you've seen the film. You realize what a great orator he really is. He's a wonderful speaker and thrilling to listen to. And so you can see him just hypnotizing and inspiring these disaffected and frustrated idealists at Berkeley.
You know, that's interesting. I actually didn't know that. But it's not surprising, really. What he's saying, at least as I understand it, has a certain appeal and power. He's just asking us to accept our condition for what it is, to not retreat from the world as it is, and to not lie to ourselves about ourselves. I don't think that's melancholic. A little tragic, yeah, maybe, but also dignified and human.
I mean, I think going a little further, if we can't find a way for our individuals and our collectives of individuals to come to greater awareness of what we're doing and why, then we're simply going to speed the system to the inevitable self-annihilation that's built into the system itself. In other words, it's actually in your interest to be more aware of what you're doing and why.
When we get back from the break, we hear Becker's take on how all this existential dread affects our kids. Stay with us. Support for The Gray Area comes from Mint Mobile. When you hear secret sauce, maybe you think of the mysterious ingredient in your favorite burger. Or perhaps it's your grandmother's terrifying meatloaf, which somehow seemed to secrete sauce. But from now on, when you hear secret sauce, I want you to think about Mint Mobile. Their secret is that they only sell wireless service online. That means they can cut the cost of retail stores and pass those savings directly to you. By switching to Mint Mobile, you can get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/gray area. That's mintmobile.com/gray area. You can cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/gray area. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Support for this show comes from NetSuite. All too often, people like the owl monkey and the Australian sea lion only see the world in black or white. Now, regular listeners of this podcast, who are mostly humans, understand that the world is more complicated than that. There's also plenty of gray areas. The world of business is a great example. See what I did there? An S&P 500 company and a small business owner have to see things differently, which is why NetSuite wants to provide products and services tailor-made for any business. NetSuite is a top-rated cloud financial system that brings accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into a single platform. NetSuite lives in the cloud, which can reduce IT costs and can improve efficiency and cut back on mistakes by bringing all your major business processes into one platform. NetSuite says that more than 37,000 companies have already made the move. Maybe it's time you did the same. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. You can head to netsuite.com/gray area. netsuite.com/gray area. netsuite.com/gray area.
Wise is the app that makes using different currencies easy. Need to send dollars to your cousin in Bali fast? Getting paid in another currency and don't want to lose out because of inflated exchange rates? Want travel money without having to slog through the currency exchange kiosk? Then Wise just might be your answer. From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise takes the guesswork out of converting currencies. You can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. In 2023, people sent over $100 billion worldwide with Wise. What's more, over half of those transfers got to their destination in less time than it takes to listen to this ad. Whether you're traveling, spending money abroad, or doing business, let Wise help you manage your money in different currencies with ease. Join 16 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
I want to go back to this idea that culture itself exists as a way for us really to conquer death, which is one of those brain-melting ideas when you first hear it. Could you just sum up what he meant by that? Because it's a hell of a claim.
I think that within culture, we have a world of symbols, because symbols themselves are theoretically immortal. So if I can create a work that makes me well-known, that work will endure and I will have an ersatz kind of immortality. This is the best immortality we can come up with, right? Is make your name. It's behind the motivation of so many people working in the arts, academics, people who are publishing, right? We're trying to put ourselves up on the leaderboard and in that sense, create an enduring legacy and live symbolically beyond our physical death. And so I think all of culture being a sort of latticework of these kinds of actions where we could just hang our name in a cloud of other names and hope it endures beyond us.
I mean, I think of it in terms of this duality. We're material creatures in a material world, subject to all the laws of that world, namely death. But then, as you're saying, we also exist in this symbolic world of human meaning, status, identity. And we attach ourselves to those things because they exist outside of time, outside the laws of nature. And our culture is the container for all this symbolic meaning. It's a really profound insight, I think, the kind of thing you can't unknow once you hear it.
Yeah, and you know, Sheldon Solomon, who's maybe the most well-known Ernest Becker scholar, he has a quote in the film where he says, you know, nature is threatening, and everything that is of nature is of finite duration. And that, I would say, is the problem. We make it a problem. So what do? We insert ourselves into a virtual environment where time and space are psychologically obliterated. Because in this world, the virtual world, in the sort of symbolic culture, it's always now. That's what I think that the advent of the internet is only sort of further accelerating, is a means by which we can all enjoy the delusions of what formerly might have been only the pharaohs and the Caesars and these historic figures who've left us their remains symbolically. Now everyone can create a sort of aerosolized virtual trail within the internet itself. So you don't even have to write a book anymore. You can just create a stream of social media, and that's your ersatz immortality. But we're all colluding with each other because, of course, everyone's doing this. And there's an unspoken tacit understanding that I'm going to like your nonsense if you can just mutually agree to like my nonsense. And together, we'll release all of the anxiety.
He had this term, immortality projects, that I think captures some of what we're talking about right now. Do you remember what he said about this?
Well, it's definitely one of the most popular phrases and ideas of his. And that's that what these works that people are embarking upon are vehicles to provide them with this sort of ersatz immortality. So they are producing some sort of symbolic testament to their own worthwhileness. And it takes and honestly, people can do this. It doesn't just mean works of art. It can also just be being a provider, you know, thinking of yourself as heroic, as a provider to a family. So everyone needs to have this sense of themselves in a sense as a sort of hero. And it's a little bit of a different take on the hero narrative that someone like Joseph Campbell made popular. It's that everyone needs the illusion that they're heroic. And so whatever projects they're involved in to create that illusion symbolically are part of an immortality project.
But all of this stuff can go terribly wrong. And
yes,
Becker was acutely aware of that. You know, I was drawn to mid-century existentialism in grad school. And I thought a lot about World War II and the horrors of that period. And I continue to think the fact of Nazism remains one of the most important problems for political theory. I mean, how in the hell was that possible? And Becker is speaking in the film about this and how the movement tapped into this deep unconscious desire to be heroic, to be part of something heroic, which is really to be part of something eternal, which is really a way of conquering death. And I think that's where this leads, or at least that's where it can lead.
In fact, all humanly caused evil is based on man's attempt to deny his creatureliness, to overcome his insignificance. All the missiles, all the airplanes, all the bombs, all human edifices are an attempt to defy eternity by proclaiming that one is something special, of standing out, of saying, you see, I have made a contribution to life. I have beat death.
The popularity of cults like Nazism really stemmed precisely from the fact that they knew people wanted this kind of heroic role. They never thrive so well as when they think they're bringing purity and goodness into the world and they're overcoming limitation and accident. And that's what he was saying. And not so much an individual study, but the collective works that cultures themselves do against other cultures. Because as long as my culture exists and there's another culture out there that believes my culture is offending their claims, their immortality claims within their culture, then my culture has to be eradicated. As long as my enemy exists and claims their heroism, I have to work to destroy them, lest they prove that my heroic claims are incorrect.
Childhood is a big part of the film because the way children are raised in this culture reflects some of the pathologies that Becker is talking about. I'm a parent, so this speaks to me for obvious reasons,
yeah.
But I also think this is just one of the most important parts of the film.
That's what motivated us to make the film, was the concern we have for our own children. And he says it himself. He says, you know, one of the things that might be overlooked about my work is that if you take the growing up process of the child is actually very aware of their vulnerability. I mean, I had recurring nightmares. I had extreme phobias. I was very worried about certain things. And what Becker really is saying is that the child actually remembers and knows that they're vulnerable. They have a certain consciousness that they eventually lose. They lose this because they realize, because in their vulnerability, they've got to plug into some other source of power. They have to draw it from something else. And so Becker says, I like to think of it as an electrical circuit, you know, father, mother. And then he says the cultural system of ideas or ideologies, these become the power source. And it's unconscious. that's where I think that he suggests that we often hand off our awareness in exchange for some peace. And it's not that we want our children to live in constant anxiety, but we also don't want them to become so unaware and uncritical that they're just available for the consumer culture to just live out a life that's uncritical and unaware.
I just love this idea that we can see the move our culture makes in this evolution from childhood to adulthood. Kids quickly learn to do what adults do, which is distract themselves with technology and entertainment. We cut themselves off from the natural world and instead live in this symbolic world. But there are real consequences to that, you know, and there's, I think it may have been a pediatrician that you're interviewing in the film. And he says that, you know, we perceive the world the way we're trained to perceive it. And he's making a point about, you know, you have a kid and they watch Baby Einstein on the Farm or whatever. And they watched it for years.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when they finally arrive at a real farm in the real world, they find it boring. Because on screens and devices, we can slice and dice time. We can control the flow of time. Everything is you know, on demand. And that's not the way the world works. And so the world becomes intolerable as a result of all this time we spend on these devices. And I mean, whether you're a parent or not, I mean, this, everyone can feel this happening in themselves. I certainly do. And I can see it in my kid.
It is part of that idea that there's this eclipse occurring where we're just obscuring reality. And because our economy no longer requires so many of us to spend so much time in the work of feeding the rest of us, it seems like this great boon to be liberated from the burden of that work. But that is, it is absolutely part of a series of Faustian trades that we have made as a society and as individuals and as, and I think those Faustian trades, we've made Faustian deals to get out of our prior Faustian obligations. And so we're on a chain of nested Faustian deals, but the consequences are playing out in ourselves sort of spiritually. Like we are bearing the consequences if we can't endure reality and prefer more and more of an artificial existence.
There's an interesting bit in the movie where Becker is talking about the curiosity of children before they're fully conditioned by our culture. And they have all these essentially religious questions, like, where do we come from? And he says, well, you know, we tell them the story of the sperm and the egg as though that really answers the question that's being asked. But it doesn't, of course. It's that is just a step in some impossibly larger historical process. And to just leave it there hides the fact that we really have no idea what we're doing here or why anything is here at all. So we just suppress these questions.
When they ask you questions like that, they really want to know what they're doing here. I mean, they really want to know. Children ask religious questions that we repress. Kid wants to know who he is, what he's doing on this planet. And we don't know, so we lie to him. And we tell him how he came to be here, which is not really how he came to be, since we don't know. And the one dangerous thing that we do with that is we eclipse the dimension of mystery. We make the kid think that there's no mystery in the world.
That particular idea in that moment was what drew Becker into the film. That anecdote was the text that I read, and I said, this is really getting at what we're talking about. He's right that children are asking, what am I doing here? Why am I on this planet? And we as parents don't know, and so we lie to them. And we actually, I think we injure them when we pretend that it's sufficient to tell them, well, there's just this thing that happens that makes you. I think that's one of the things about Becker I really appreciate most. He was on a panel for Human Potential, and it was with a bunch of Esalen types, maybe with what you might imagine an early 70s kind of spirit of Human Potential. I think there was talk of ESP and some of these other things, and Becker's a little bit of an oddball in that sense relative to those guys. But they're talking about joy, and at some point he corrects them and says, I think that joy ultimately is a religious thing. And I think it comes from the notion that life is miraculous. He says, you know, this is like Francis of Assisi or the Hasidic joy. He said, this is a very hard thing for people to attain. For most people, it's very hard to believe that. That's a very profound point. It's not a given that this is actually an accident at all. It's not. No matter how much we persist a certain view of the world, it's a remarkable thing to exist.
You have 6 kids, right?
Seven.
Seven kids.
Seven sons.
Are the kids in the film, are those your kids?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. When I say I have 7 sons, I know automatically for most people, they make a set of assumptions about, well, oh, okay, I get it. You must be Mormon or maybe you're Catholic. You know, you're from some conditioning that leads you to have a large family. Laura and I are from modest-sized families. We don't have any conditioning that would lead us to have a large family. It's not part of our respective lives, but I think the joy that we both experienced in being parents was such a surprise. I think we're both pretty existential individually. And the gift of being able to have a child and be able to teach them about the world was so striking. It was like a discovery to us, like, wow, this is so wonderful, so gratifying. When you're working on a project like a film, you might be working 2 or 3 or 4 years on to finish something and then deliver it and then work another 2 or 3 or 4 years on it. And that's a long time to work for a short little window of awareness. But with parenting, you know, it's this aggregate of all these little moments. Reading books at night to the kids and things like that are just so deeply gratifying. So I think that's, for us, what we were experiencing as individuals and as a husband and wife. And then Terrence Malick is an executive producer on this film, and he made a comment to Laura quite a while back when the kids were visiting at his office. He said, it's like watching a series of nested Russian dolls or something, because they look so similar. And so when we were filming, we decided to sort of use this as part of a device to create the illusion of this prototypical child just aging as the film progresses. So that's where that came in, as a way to simulate that without having to spend 15 years filming a baby through teenagedom.
How are you navigating all these challenges with your kids?
Our oldest son, who's 18, has an iPad, but he's also a classical violinist. And so he uses his iPad a lot for his music. But none of our kids have actual iPhones, and we're not going to give them iPhones. We have given them, you know, dumb phones or Apple Watches to avoid having that access. It's not that we're not letting them participate in culture. We sit down and we watch movies with them and we watch certain television shows, but we don't let them indefinitely access it. It takes extra work. It's more work.
Yeah, I say all the time that it's almost impossible to be in the world without also being of the world, without becoming a product of it. And this is the world. This is the culture we're all swimming in. And it is very hard to swim in that without being remade in its image.
Absolutely. It's such a sophisticated economic system. It is so remarkably sophisticated in its ability to convert us into consumers. And it's in its interest that we not be aware. You can have an entire life play out in this commercialized symbolic order and never once become aware of the uniqueness that you had as an individual and what was special about you and what opportunity you had to reveal something that no one else can. We're all up against that. We're up against it. And it's insidious. One has to be very vigilant and work very hard to avoid it.
After one more short break, why making this film has changed Jeff. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You've heard it before. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. But it's more than just a tagline, because State Farm agents are small business owners themselves who live and work in your community. And if you're in the market for small business insurance, who better to work with than an agent who understands what it takes? State Farm agents can help you create a personalized insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. Talk to your local State Farm agent today about small business insurance. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Wow, that guy means business.
Just an amazing player.
No, not him, the sports photographer behind him.
What?
He has a business bank account with QuickBooks Money where he earns 5% annual percentage yield, so he's scoring big on and off the field. You might even say he's the MVB.
MVB?
The most valuable business.
Making your money work harder. That's how you business differently. Intuit QuickBooks. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank. Member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Listen, I'm 24 and I still live at home. Like, what? For sure. Are you kidding me? My man and I, we attempted to move out.
Yeah, that'll be $1,600 for a studio apartment, not including groceries, not including...
Last fall, the National Association of Realtors released data showing that housing affordability had fallen to its lowest point since the 1980s for reasons of economy, American.
There just aren't a lot of home sales going on. And there's really kind of a standoff right now between buyers and sellers.
That standoff leads to another kind of standoff.
It's always fun being 40-something years old and having to live with your parents again. And I know it's all my fault.
Sir, I don't know your life, but on Today Explained, a two-part series on how it might not be your fault. Our housing reality bites and the American dream is in your childhood bedroom. Series sponsored by Mint Mobile. Today Explained, in your feed every weekday.
And I'll tell my mom, Mom, I'm going to the bathroom, I'll be back. If I'm not out in like 3 minutes, dog, she's like knocking on the door going, everything okay in there? Yeah, Mom, everything's cool, dog.
Becker did not seem especially sanguine about the state of American culture. Do you think he was right about where we were then, and I guess more importantly, where we were heading? Do you think if he was still around today, he would feel sad but vindicated?
You know, when he spoke with Sam, there's a moment in there where he is talking about his earlier books. And he says, you know, one of the mistakes he felt like he made was that he tried to kind of be hip to the moment. And he said, you know, I think with this book, The Denial of Death, I think he says it this way. He says, you know, to use Paul Tillich, the theologian's reference, I switched from a horizontal to a vertical frame. I'm no longer addressing myself to the future apotheosis of man. That's a really efficient way to say something. But part of what I think he's saying, if I can speculate, is think about the idea of progressivism just very broadly. In terms of unspoken assumptions, I think there's an unspoken assumption within much of progressivism that we're building a utopic world and someday we'll get there. That there's this unspoken assumption that we're going to get to this place. And I think he switched to this existential and ultimately sort of philosophical, even theological frame. And I think it liberated him in a way from the burden of having to pretend that within the math that's running that we're going to make it. I know that sounds extreme, but that's how I take it. You know, that he's no longer encumbered with this need to keep affirming, but don't worry, we can do it. We can get there. That's as American as it gets. Like, it's heroic intellectually to have done what he did and to just be honest about it and to stop trying to have to put any sort of spin on it to fashion it to the moment, but just to speak the truth as he saw it.
Is there anything you feel like Becker got wrong, importantly?
I think there's many people will quibble with small details within his work. There are things that people take issue with. I mean, Sam Keen points out that the book Denial of Death itself is overwhelmingly sort of male in its way of thinking. Sam Keen asked him, how would this be different if you'd been a woman? And like, it was some attempt to kind of address that. So I think there are those aspects, but I think what he is right about and what he's nailed is so outweighs where he was wrong. If you can accept the basic premise, you don't care about the small little things because the substance of his ideas are so compelling.
I think that's right. I really do. And this film was an opportunity for me to revisit some of these ideas. I think I'd mentioned this to you when we were discussing this conversation that, you know, I read Becker a little bit in graduate school, and then I kind of just left him to the side. And this forced me to return to his ideas, and I'm grateful for that. And I found myself thinking hard about all of this near the end of the film, you know, this need we have to be remembered or great or whatever. Maybe the lie is that we have to do something other than just live our lives in dignity. You know, we live, we die, the world rolls on. Just being present for your partner, for your kids, for your friends, being content with that. You know, how does one live a heroic life? I don't know. Maybe that's it. Live in truth. Be useful to those around you. Don't pretend to know more than you do. Don't demand more of the world than the world can give. I mean, that seems to be Becker's philosophy in a nutshell, and it seems about right to me. I don't know if it's heroic, but it is wise, and that's enough for me.
Well said. It is wise.
Has making the film, sitting with Becker's ideas again, changed you?
I have to say, to be honest, I mean, this is so much of the material that we reviewed and his conversation with Sam. There are times where we just would listen to it and weep. There's so much beauty and there's so much sensitivity that it's hard to hear such sort of sensitive material and not be moved. It made me only more appreciative of him, even though I already was so appreciative of him. I think that's one of the things about this kind of work that can be personally very gratifying, is a chance to do the research and help other people benefit from him also. That's ultimately how I feel, is that he's a personal hero. He really did help me in terms of just providing language around things that are very hard to process. That's a great gift. And I just feel a remarkable gratitude to be able to work on something like this, because you can't spend as much time unpaid as we do on these projects not to care about it. In the process of making documentaries, you are constantly indebted and reliant on the kindness of strangers and other people. You're dependent on people who work in libraries to go look for you in certain places when you ask them. And there's people like Lila who flew to Seattle to dig around this cabin trying to find these cassettes. And Sam Keen in his 80s sat with us in Sonoma and revisited this episode in his life, and especially Marie, Becker's widow. It just can't be done without people like that. So I believe in his ideas, and I hope that it's a worthy testament to him. If that proves to be the case, if more people get the benefit of reading him, I'll be gratified, truly. So it has changed me, and I hope that it brings in more people.
One's whole lifestyle is a dishonesty that attempts to elude the existential dilemma. I think this is a chilling revelation about human beings. Our whole life is a beating of people over the head to try to prove to them we're here because we're special and good, and look at me, look at me. Love me, admire me, look what I'm doing, look what I'm doing, look how good. Yes, yes, all right, you deserve to be here, great.
Once again, the film is called All Illusions Must Be Broken. It was great. I highly recommend it. If you want to see it, and of course you do, you can go and check it out at Jeff's website, twobirdsfilm.com. That's T-W-O. Jeff, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much.
This episode was produced by John Ahrens, edited by Jorge Just, engineered by Patrick Boyd, and Alex Overington wrote our theme music. All right, as always, I want to hear what you thought of the episode. This was a particularly heavy one, but it meant a lot to me. I hope it meant a lot to you as well. Drop us a line at thegrayarea@vox.com and let us know. Rate, review, subscribe, you know the drill. New episodes of The Gray Area drop on Mondays. Listen and subscribe. The Gray Area is part of Vox, which doesn't have a paywall. Help us keep Vox free by going to vox.com/give.
This podcast was supported by Choiceology, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. hosted by Katie Milkman, an award-winning behavioral scientist and author of the best-selling book How to Change, Choiceology is a show about the psychology and economics behind our decisions. Hear true stories from Nobel laureates, authors, athletes, and more about why we do the things we do. Listen to Choiceology at schwab.com/podcast or wherever you listen.